This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
I appreciate you joining us again on Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. Celtic Throne is an epic new Irish dance production premiering in Armstrong Auditorium here in Edmond, Oklahoma on June 28th, just 4 days away. The last 2 weeks, we've been talking with directors, choreographers, and dancers from the show. Today, we're going to talk to Brian Byrne, who composed most of the music for the show. Then we're going to talk about what seems to be a paradox. The same government officials and media who enforced the strong-handed coronavirus lockdowns with gusto suddenly turned around and began supporting mass unrest and lawlessness after the death of George Floyd. On one hand, they were acting like tyrants and autocrats. Then suddenly, they were revolutionaries and anarchists. We're going to talk about how it is possible for leftists to believe in what seems like these two opposite ideas and what the common denominator is. Taiwan's relationship to China has long been complicated and tense, but China has long thought that eventually Taiwan would become fully part of China if it just waited long enough. Well, this isn't happening. In fact, the forces that are trying to make Taiwan completely independent are growing stronger. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about how China is responding by resorting to tougher measures, even force, to bring Taiwan under its power. And at the end of the program today, I'll give you a couple of tips on how to become a deeper thinker. Let's get started with our conversation with the composer of Celtic Throne, Brian Byrne. Brian is an award-winning film and television composer, songwriter, and producer. He composed music for the world-famous Irish dance show Heartbeat of Home. And it so happens that this native of Ireland is married to a native Oklahoman and has a home very nearby our offices here in Edmond. He's composed a dynamite score for this production, 9 pieces that inspired some very exciting choreography. Our dancers love dancing to this music. It tells a wonderful story. It's very dramatic and cinematic, and we are very happy to have Brian via Skype. Hello, Brian.
Hello, how are you doing? I'm delighted to be here.
Marvelous. I'm doing great. So I have to start by saying I have 3 children in the dance troupe, and I've been drafted to play Baran and mandolin in the band for the performances. I've been listening to this music a lot, and it is terrific. I think people are really going to love it. So thank you very much for contributing that.
My pleasure.
So you do a big variety of projects, and you compose in a lot of different genres, but you're from Ireland. Would you say Irish music, Irish folk, Irish dance is kind of your native musical language?
I think so. I mean, I grew up around a lot of traditional Irish musicians, and Ireland is such a small country that you don't have to go far before you bump into somebody with a fiddle or a baron or an accordion.
Yeah.
I grew up in a very musical family. We weren't a traditional Irish family. We studied classical music, and I played in a band with my father, a wedding band when I was a kid, and I always played by ear. But really, it was when I went to college in Scotland that I had a baptism of fire with Irish music. I learned more about Irish music living in Scotland in the UK than I did in Ireland. Just so happened the people that I was around. And to make ends meet during college, I would play harpsichord in a classical trio in a museum one night. Hmm. Then the next night, I might play jazz in a jazz club. And then another night, I'd be drafted to play with folk groups and traditional groups. And I just was always surrounded and drawn toward my native kind of music. And my sister-in-law is a choreographer. She choreographed the original girl's part on Riverdance. So I would do... She would draft me to write some music for shows and bits of things. So over the last 20 years or so, I've ended up writing a lot of Irish traditional music, and which led to my, you know, working on Heartbeat of Home, which was from the producers of Riverdance. So initially I wasn't a traditional Irish musician, but I think it's in our DNA. And I think if you hang around those people long enough, by osmosis, you can soak that stuff up.
Now, when you we approached you toward the end of last year, you had a gap in your schedule to be able to do this project. You came and visited Armstrong Auditorium, and we were talking at that point about how when you have non-Irish composers who try to write Irish music, that there's something that doesn't necessarily feel quite authentic about it. Maybe you could talk about that. What is it that makes Irish music authentic, and what would you say makes it unique?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's the form and the structure. The Irish music they're dance tunes. So they're essentially jigs, which is a 6/8 dance that was all across Europe. Very, very old. It's a 6/8 thing, and it's usually 8 bars of an A section, 8 bars of a B section. And then you'll have reels, which are in 4/4 time, very common. Or you'll have slip jigs. So there's a set of, it's all dance music. And first of all, you need to know the forms of each dance. It's the same as classical music. If you learn Bach, right, for instance, he wrote jigs, and he wrote, you know, a lot of dance music, because that's what people did back then. They didn't really have stereos. They had musicians in the corner that were hired playing for dances. And the same in Irish music, unless you understand the basic principle, the form of the dance, there's no way you can write for Irish dancers or musicians. And really, I there was a book that I got when I was a kid. It was O'Neill's Tunes. This musician in Ireland, a couple of hundred years ago, he wrote down a lot of the Irish tunes that were passed down through. And I remember when I was at college, I think I played through every one of them just to learn what this music is and to learn the form of it. And so really, you have to start off with the form, and then you need to know the melodic structure. It's a very pleasing sound. It's very, I won't go too detailed, but it's very diatonic and easy on the ear, because the instruments were non-chromatic instruments way back then. So they're pretty simple scales.
Yeah.
So really, I think you have to do your 1,000 hours of, or your 10,000 hours of either listening or playing or being involved in that music. And then just you take the task at hand, which is we need a piece that's a reel, we need a piece that's a jig, and then I sit down, I'll write down without any harmony or chords or anything, I'll write the tune out, and it's all about the melody. And if the melody's not strong, then it's not good Irish music, because one of the strongest things about Irish music or Celtic music is the melodies. And if you slow down any of these dances, a fast reel or a fast jig, if you slow it down really, really slow, you'll get the most awesome ballad you've ever heard. It's a trick I tell people, that if you want to write a really soulful Irish song, just go to the book of tunes and slow down any of those tunes, and you'll find the most beautiful soulful tunes. So really, you have to live that music for a good while.
Yeah, that's very cool. So we really were thrilled that you agreed to do the Celtic Throne soundtrack. What made you decide this was a project that you wanted to undertake?
Well, I have a house in Oklahoma. My wife is from Oklahoma. My kids go to school in Oklahoma. I'm a film composer, so with the luxury of technology, I can write anywhere in the world. I spent almost 20 years in Los Angeles, and my agents never knew where I lived, because I did everything over email, over phone, and now we can do it with Zoom and Skype. So we bought a house here in Oklahoma, and I love it. I'm building a studio at the back of the house as we speak, and I hope to employ local musicians. And and so when Paris Turgeon called me up and said, we want to do an Irish dance show in Oklahoma, first of all, I was gobsmacked that there's even an Irish dance troupe in Oklahoma City. So that had me kind of intrigued.
Yeah.
And then she told me she had seen Heartbeat at Home in London and that they were big fans. And then one of the choreographers that you guys work with was in Riverdance. And so there was this crazy connection that seemed too good to overlook. And all of the work that I'm doing here seems to be coming out of Los Angeles or coming out of the UK or Ireland. So I thought it'd be interesting to try and do some work here in Oklahoma. And I thought it'd be a wonderful opportunity. And I came to see the Armstrong Auditorium, and I was just blown away by the concert hall and how nice you guys all were, and it just fit in between my schedule. I was after finishing a movie, and it just was the perfect time to write it. So it all seemed to work out, and the collaboration was one of the easiest things I've ever done. Just you guys gave me the brief and I went to town and I did corrections and notes back and forth, which I love doing. And it was just a lovely experience.
Well, I would be interested in more information about that. Just that you wrote 9 pieces for the show. Initially, it was intended to maybe be the introduction and the finale, and it ended up being pretty much the whole show. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what the directors were looking for, the specific input that they gave you, and then how that process unfolded with the back and forth.
Well, as a film composer, sometimes we are working to a brief all the time. You have a director or a producer that says, I need X, Y, and Z, or else you look at the picture and it needs to be 2 minutes, 6 seconds, whatever. So
right.
I think I said to Paris that when I met her, I can either go away and do this myself, but I think you guys are designing a dance show. Let me know what you want in great detail. Mm-hmm. Put it all on paper and I'll take it from there. So, you know, she said she wanted a big opening and it needed to be a reel and it needed to be this amount of time. And really the notes or the brief I got was really detailed and to the point from your director and from Paris. And I just really went away and I spent a good few weeks just writing the 2 pieces. And I think they seemed to work. Paris seemed to like them. Mm-hmm. And then I think if you're going to do a whole show, sometimes if you have a whole lot of composers, you're missing a thread through, and I think it seemed to make more sense if I were to write most of the pieces, because then I could steal the themes from myself. So in other words, uh-huh. I could write a slow theme, a farewell theme, and then at some stage I could maybe use that as a counter melody in another fast tune. You know, if you're writing a symphony, you use motifs,
yeah,
and themes, and you build on it. So rather than just a hodgepodge of 9-10 random tunes, it's almost like a symphonic Celtic work where each thing has a reason and it's sonically linked. It's the same traditional Irish musicians playing on each track, and I just thought it would be from a coherent point of view, which is what I did with Harpy to Home. And when you work on shows, it's kind of easier if you have one thread going through. So that was a joy to do that.
That is marvelous. Could you give us a little insight into just how you work? You're composing, I'm assuming, on like a synthesized setup. You're putting ideas into a notation program or some kind of a sequencer and working from there?
Yeah. What I do, first of all, is I write out the melody specifically for, well, really for anything. If it's for a movie, I will sit at the piano and try and come up with a theme. And if it's a memorable theme, then I'll transfer it into my computer. Mm. I'll write it out in Sibelius first. So it's kind of old school. Even though I'm using the computer, I write out so I can see the form. I can see that it's 16 bars, and then at 17 bar, I'll write in, I'm going to do this change here. So rather than just putting my hands on a keyboard and throwing whatever comes out first, that tends to lead to a kind of mediocre level of composition, I think. I mean, I think that the initial ideas are good. You improvise the initial ideas, but then I think what works best for me is if I write it, compose it, arrange it, the way that arrangers and orchestrators do. That way I have the map, and then from Sibelius I'll open up Logic, and I have a ton of sample libraries from Logic, and I'll mock up everything. Logic is a program that a sequencer, a DAW, that film composers use, and it's very convenient. It means that, so I do everything in MIDI samples first, no audio, and the reason is choreographers always want changes, and they always, can you change the tempo here?
Yep.
Can you cut out 26 and a half bars? If you do that with audio, it gets a little tough, but at least with MIDI, you can control to change the tempos. And then once we're set and we're agreed that this is the speed and the feel and the tempo, then I will either go to a studio where I have a symphony orchestra, or I will have musicians, or in this case, because COVID-19 kind of kicked in, we did a lot of the traditional Irish musicians online virtually, and it worked out great. I mean, obviously it's nicer to be in the room with them, but with the current climate, that's the way we went. So it's a very strategic, you know, but first of all, I do improvise the themes. I do try and come up, and then I'll write them out, realize them in Logic, send it off, mix it, and then I'll go to Pro Tools and then do final delivery on Pro Tools.
Mm. So I have to say, there are some dynamite performances on here. You've used some top drawer musicians from all over the place who recorded for this project, and you're doing basically all of this remotely. I'm wondering how much the coronavirus lockdown doesn't even affect your ability to do a project like this when you're able to just say, here's the music, here's the track to play to, and then you've got musicians remotely recording these things for you.
Exactly. And I learned that from, I studied film composition in London, in the Royal College of Music in London, opposite the Albert Hall. When I went there, I was too broke to go to a concert in the Albert Hall, but I had, my teacher was Joseph Horowitz. He was this old European guy, still alive, he's in his 90s. And the biggest thing I learned from him with composition was you need to write your music. So if you are on your way to the recording session and you get hit by a bus, this kind of weird thing, but if you get hit by a bus and somebody picks up your music and they bring it to the soundstage, that music will sound the same on the soundstage without you, pretty much as if you were there. So when I say I write in Sibelius and I write everything detailed, that's where it's like building a house or designing a house. If the map is right and the architecture, if it's all in the plans, then it's easy from there. And what I do then is I just send an MP3, I send the details, and I send the sheet music. And now everyone, with these lockdowns, more and more people are getting microphones and systems at home.
Yeah,
and it just worked like a dream. So I was very lucky. And yes, luckily, I'll touch wood, we're not too affected by COVID-19 with that process. Obviously, for live concerts, I've had a lot of that stuff canceled, but it's okay. Yeah. I'm very busy and I've movies, and so I'm one of the lucky ones, I think.
Well, that is fantastic. It's great to get some insight into what went in behind the scenes on the soundtrack to this production. We've been talking with the composer of the music for Celtic Throne, Brian Byrne. June 28th, this Sunday, is the premiere, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, Central Daylight Time. And we have additional performances coming here on July 5th and July 7th. Come to Armstrong Auditorium if you can. You can pick up tickets at armstrongauditorium.org. It's also going to be in Branson, Missouri on June 30th and July 1st. And that July 5th performance will be streaming online. You can buy a virtual ticket at armstrongauditorium.org. Fantastic, Brian. I think we're going to have a lot of excited people hearing this score very soon. We appreciate it.
I'm delighted. I'm delighted it's in Oklahoma, and I'm delighted it's Irish music, that it's having such an impact and that young people are involved, and I'm thrilled to be asked to do it, and I'm wishing you all the great success with it.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
If you follow the prescriptions of the left in America and Britain, you're in a quandary. Should you stay locked down at home to prevent the spread of coronavirus, or should you take to the streets with the crowds to protest systemic racism? Recent weeks have exposed this stunning paradox. On the one hand, government officials took huge strides toward unprecedented authoritarianism, and the media cheered them on. Fear of COVID-19 caused draconian lockdowns, closed businesses, restricted travel, shut down churches, enforced empty streets and public places. Officials mandated social distancing and mask wearing. They imposed massive fines for violations. They arrested people for going to the beach. They invaded people's privacy. They followed them with drones and tracked their movements through cell phone data. And they said this was what was needed for society to heal. They flexed their muscles, they talked like dictators, they showed people who was boss. Their word was the law, and anyone who violated it was ignorant, irresponsible, anti-science, lawless. Then suddenly, these same people turned on a dime and embraced utter anarchy. George Floyd was killed, and now the need was not to respect the law, it was to defy the law. It was time to act out, to rise up in unified anger and protest, even violence. Mobs moved in great throngs to smash windows, loot businesses, burn cars, attack police, destroy cities, create mayhem, and law enforcement backed down. The same police who had been told to stringently enforce quarantine measures against citizens who committed crimes like walking down the street or failing to wear a face mask or visiting family members were now told to stand down and watch as citizens committed crimes of vandalism, arson, robbery, and assault. And they're still permitting people to maintain autonomous control over several city blocks in Seattle. And as anarchy has reigned, government officials are explaining how it's all justified. It's appropriate. It's necessary. They say this is what is needed for society to heal. They actually say the need for violent protest outweighs the need for containing the health risks of COVID-19. Just days before, containing this virus was worth shutting down the entire nation's economy. But overnight, the opposite was true. Containing this virus was not worth shutting down these destructive, lawless protests. Peaceful economic activity had to stop. Violent, subversive activity could proceed. At the snap of a finger, the authoritarians turned into anarchists. It really makes your head spin. How is this possible? How does the same mind harbor these two seemingly contradictory convictions? How can the left in America and Britain simultaneously believe in tyranny and rebellion, totalitarianism and revolution? It's an important question because what has happened here actually reveals a lot about the nature of the left in America today. What seems like a paradox is actually quite consistent. The link between authoritarianism and anarchy is very strong. In some ways, these are two sides of the same coin, and you have to understand this to grasp what a threat it is to our nations. To truly grasp what is happening, you have to understand a few things about God. God created human beings, and he created us for a marvelous purpose and with an incredible potential. He has very exciting plans for our future. He gave us intellect and reason that he didn't give to any of the animals. He gave us emotions and creative capacity unique to humans. The ability to relate to others and to love. He gave us a sense of morality, of right and wrong. And he's trying to help us to come to think as he does, to be able to learn, to plan, design, produce, and even create like he does. To help us grow in our capacity, in our capability, our responsibility, our character. God gave us dominion over the material world to teach us how to take care of things, how to build and maintain things. He created marriage and family to teach us how to care for others, how to develop teamwork and unity and selflessness and sacrifice and love. And he also gave us his spiritual law governing our relationships within family and in society, and even how we take care of the earth and material things. He created an economic system based around private property ownership to foster responsible stewardship and hard work and industry, as well as voluntary charity to look after our neighbors. This truth about God is beautifully expressed in America's Declaration of Independence. It says that all men are created equal and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Everything God does is aimed at helping us to grow up, to be accountable for our own choices, to strive for excellence, to grow in ever greater capacity and duty and authority. He wants us to live productive, noble lives where we build strong families and have prosperity and right ambition and strong moral fiber and solid character. As we do that, we're preparing for the wonderful future he has in store for us. You can read what the Bible reveals about that by reading our free book by Herbert W. Armstrong, The Incredible Human Potential. God is a God of freedom. He wants people to be free to fulfill our fullest potential. Now, America and Britain have done an extraordinary job of giving more freedom and prosperity to more people than any other nations in history. And people of every race, color, and creed, we should note. That's something that all of us in these nations should be extremely grateful for. Once you understand God's goals and purposes for human beings, then you see that the common denominator of those two seemingly opposite trends that I mentioned at the beginning, the authoritarianism and the anarchy, the common denominator is that they are both aimed at stripping people of the freedoms God wants us to have. They are both aimed squarely at preventing people from fulfilling their God-given potential. First, let's talk about anarchy. Now, it's clear how these people who are running around destroying everything are enemies of civilization. They're indiscriminately tearing down what others have painstakingly built. They don't know how to build. They only know how to destroy. There's nothing positive or uplifting or godly about this force. It plays to the very worst in human beings. It's antithetical to reason. It's fueled by anger and hatred. And to whatever degree this force actually succeeds in toppling the existing order, it will be unable to replace it with anything better. It's only going to leave ruin in its wake. History shows that civilization is actually a fragile thing. It's always threatened by the forces of barbarism that are knocking at the doors. And God actually wants to keep those forces in check in order to guarantee people's rights and help us to attain our potential. So one tool that God uses to do that is our national governments. God actually puts authorities in positions of power to keep the barbarians at bay. And we should be thankful for that and pay heed to those authorities. The Apostle Paul talks about this in Romans 13. He writes there, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." That is an extraordinary statement. You can read in Daniel 4 and verse 32, where it says, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever he will." The Bible shows that this is not God's world. It's actually governed by Satan the devil. But even though God does not directly govern, he does rule. He is involved in choosing who will rule over other men. Verse 2 in Romans 13 says, "Whosoever therefore resists the power resists the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation." Paul calls the ordinances of these human governments the ordinance of God. That's what holds society together. Verse 3 says, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil." And verse 4 says, "He is the minister of God to you for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil." God wants those governments in place. Society without government is a disaster. If there were no government, this world would look like Lord of the Flies. Will and Ariel Durant wrote in The Lessons of History that Alexander Pope, one of the greatest English poets, thought that only a fool would dispute over forms of government. History has a good word to say for all of them and for government in general. Since men love freedom and the freedoms of individuals in society requires some regulation of conduct, the first condition of freedom is its limitation. Make it absolute, and it dies in chaos. So anarchy seems like the ultimate freedom, but in reality, it is the opposite, because there's no structure in place to protect freedom, to secure it and defend it. You end up with the strong doing whatever they want to do and at the expense of the weak. So Durant writes, so the prime task of government is to establish order. Organized central force is the sole alternative to incalculable and disruptive force in private hands. That's what this passage in Romans 13 is saying. It tells us to be subject to these authorities, for they are God's ministers. Render, therefore, to all their dues. Tribute to whom tribute is due. Custom to whom custom. Fear to whom fear. Honor to whom honor. Have you ever thought about that? That government officials are God's ministers? Obviously, they don't govern perfectly, but imperfect government is better than no government. Not until the kingdom of God is established on earth will human beings have the opportunity to live under perfect government. And thankfully, that day is coming soon. But the forces of anarchy aim to undermine God's plan and debase human beings, denying them the blessings of an ordered society that enables all people of every color, old and young, strong and weak, great and small, to thrive. It is fundamentally an anti-God movement and force. Now, authoritarianism looks like the opposite of anarchy, but it actually has fundamentally the same goals. And in most cases, authoritarians use anarchy and chaos as a tool to impose their authority. Everything God seeks to accomplish in the lives of human beings, authoritarians work to dismantle. God encourages freedom within his moral law, true liberty that comes from strong individual character. Authoritarians often encourage moral license, permitting all sorts of immorality that debases individuals and fragments families and destroys lives. But this kind of behavior destroys true freedom. As Jesus Christ said, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. The weaker families are, the more people need to rely on the government for support. Authoritarians encourage dependency. They always tend toward socialistic and communistic practices, and that shifts decision-making and power away from individuals and families and puts it in the hands of the government. As governments take people's wealth and redistribute it as they see fit, that inevitably suppresses people's personal motivation and ambition. It makes people shiftless and idle. So rather than striving for excellence, people settle into self-satisfaction and mediocrity. God's government prepares man for ever greater capacity and duty and authority. Socialism strips people of responsibility. God encourages industry and he fosters stewardship through private property ownership. But statist governments create complacency through wealth redistribution. And when the government redistributes wealth, it always costs a lot of wealth and the overall standard of living drops. And it also kills off the opportunity and the desire to demonstrate individual charity. The government takes care of the poor, and it takes your money to do that. There's nothing voluntary about it. And then when the poor receive that kind of charity, rather than feeling gratitude, they feel entitled, and they get really agitated and angry if anything interrupts the flow of those benefits. God's government obliges people to be accountable for their choices, but socialist government insulates people from the consequences of bad decisions. It robs people of their individual dignity, and it turns them into wards of the state. At heart, authoritarians aim to put themselves in place of God. They want people looking to them instead of looking to God. And the more authoritarian the leader, the more he creates a kind of religion of the state. And on top of that, the greater the role that government plays in people's lives, the more power it has to trample economic and social freedoms. This is all exactly the opposite of what God wants for us. And that really exposes the true nature of this two-headed monster, this movement in America and Britain that is somehow simultaneously anarchic and authoritarian. Leftists demonstrate both of these things because they both manifest the same satanic impulse to destroy people, to strip them of freedom, to prevent them from growing and building and creating the way that God intends. At its core, that's what this movement is. It's anti-God. It is against God, and it's destructive of God's plans for human beings. The better you come to know God, the easier it is to recognize a counterfeit like the one taking over our nations.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
The question of Taiwan's independence has long been a contentious one, and it increasingly is one that appears China feels compelled to answer with force, as we will now hear in this report by Jeremiah Jacques.
For decades, the People's Republic of China thought that when it came to Taiwan, time was on its side. Back in 1949, after the Chinese Communist Party had won control of China's mainland, nationalists fled to the island of Taiwan and established a republic there. And the two sides remained at a stalemate for years, but since the late 1970s, relations began to warm, and China came to believe that all it would have to do was wait. And just to keep growing more powerful, economically and militarily, and keep growing more economically integrated with Taiwan, and more socially and culturally integrated with Taiwan as well. And at the same time, China would just have to keep on maneuvering behind the scenes to squeeze Taiwan out of integration with other nations. And eventually, after all of this had gone on for long enough, the Taiwanese people would come to see that assimilating themselves back into China was the only logical choice. From 2008 to 2016, the Chinese were especially hopeful about this strategy. During this time, Taiwan was led by President Ma Ying-jeou. He was distinctly pro-China, and Taiwan was largely behind him. China recognized this and eased up on coercive methods for bringing Taiwan under China's power. And instead, China began finding more and more areas to cooperate on ever deeper levels with Taiwan. And China worked to boost social and cultural interactions of all kinds between the two sides. Why not substitute the stick for the carrot? President Ma was accommodating to Beijing. The Taiwanese were leaning toward China. And Taiwan seemed committed to the 1992 consensus, which said the two sides agreed that there is only one China. That consensus did allow some choice regarding how exactly the one China model would be interpreted by either side, but despite this wiggle room, it built the framework for the two to interact in. So under Ma's Taiwan, sentiments for China were warm, and it looked like China had time to let them grow warmer. And to let Taiwan grow so dependent on China that the anti-Chinese sentiments would dry up, and then Taiwan would peacefully unite with China under a one-country, two-systems model. But in 2016, the people of Taiwan elected a new ruler, Tsai Ing-wen. She and her Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, are pro-independence and pro-Taiwan, the opposite of Ma Ying-jeou and the pro-unification-leaning Kuomintang party that he led. Tsai was riding a swell of resurgent DPP power. This swell was fueled largely by a demographic shift underway in Taiwan, with each generation of people identifying more as Taiwanese and less as Chinese. The shift had gone into overdrive after 2012, when a new man became head of China. This was Xi Jinping, And the Taiwanese saw that under his leadership, China was becoming more nationalistic, more coercive, and more expansionistic. Xi also took the wiggle room out of the 1992 consensus, strengthening the link between that framework and the notion of one country, two systems. This was an assertion that mainland communist China was the one true China, into which Taiwan would be required to assimilate. This more forceful China sobered many Taiwanese. It caused even Mao's Kuomintang Party to back away from the 1992 consensus, and it bolstered pro-independence sentiments across the island. Tsa and the DPP began calling for a review of Taiwan's constitution. They began working toward building deeper trade links between Taiwan and Western nations, and with several Southeast Asian countries as well. She began deepening Taiwan's security ties with the U.S., and worked out deals to acquire massive amounts of American weaponry. And the U.S. began increasing its number of patrols in the South China Sea and through the Taiwan Strait. France and the United Kingdom began to follow the U.S.'s lead. Then, shortly into her term, Tsa also began tacitly rejecting the 1992 consensus. And then, this January, she was re-elected with a landslide victory. With 57% of the votes, she was head and shoulders above all other candidates. China closely and furiously looked on after that landslide victory when U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo congratulated Tsa on her re-election. And Pompeo specifically praised her determination to stand up to China. In the months that followed, China grappled with debilitating shutdowns caused by the coronavirus that it unleashed on the world. But Taiwan emerged as a white knight in the pandemic, containing it almost immediately with targeted quarantines, and then helping other nations to implement aspects of Taiwan's successful strategy. Xi Jinping's China also watched wrathfully as Taiwan created legal channels to help citizens of Hong Kong to immigrate to Taiwan in order to escape the new draconian laws China is enacting over the former British colony. All of this made Taiwanese people more proud to be Taiwanese, and more afraid and more disdainful toward China. And China saw all of it as indications of a coming change in Taiwan's security and international status. China saw it as Taiwan setting the stage for a potential switch from de facto independence to de jure independence. This would mean an openly sovereign Taiwan. The possibility of losing Taiwan in such a way is anathema to Xi Jinping's China for a number of reasons. Part of it is related to the idea of the final success of the Chinese Communist Party. Part of it's also tied to an emotional concept of some historic picture of a greater and more powerful China. But highest on the list is China's national security. Taiwan's strategic location, just about 100 miles off the Chinese coast, means it splits China's near seas in two. Taiwan is part of the first island chain, that arc of landmasses stretching from above Japan all the way down to the Philippines and down to Indonesia. In Chinese military doctrine, this first island chain is an area of extreme importance. It's the region China absolutely must secure in the event of warfare, because the U.S. or other adversaries could otherwise potentially blockade China's coast. This would pose an existential threat to China, because its export-dependent economy would be crippled, and even more importantly, it would have no way to bring the Middle Eastern oil and gas that it depends on so heavily into the country. And it would also struggle to bring the food imports that its population is increasingly dependent on into China. So for these reasons, the Chinese are dead set on being able to control everything between China and this first island chain, and that includes Taiwan. Stratfor's Roger Baker wrote about this last Sunday, writing, quote, "Taiwan is crucial for both any foreign containment strategy and for China's confidence and security in the East and South China Seas, areas critical to China's national defense, food security, and international trade." End quote. So this all adds up to show China that somewhat suddenly, time is no longer on its side regarding Taiwan. And so China is now in the process of modifying its approach to Taiwan in a worrying way. China has long used five main toolkits for its Taiwanese policy. These are incentivization, disruption, isolation, constraint, and force. From 2008 to 2016, when Taiwan was led by President Ma, the Chinese mainly used the first toolkit, incentivization. And China would occasionally use disruption and isolation, but only selectively, to gently remind Taiwan how dark its days would be if China substituted its carrots for sticks. Now, though, under President Tsai, and with so much anti-China sentiment building in Taiwan, and with Taiwan's ties to the third-party nations growing stronger, China is tossing incentivization aside, and is relying heavily on disruption, isolation, and constraint. We see this with the growing number of nations that China has bribed into denying Taiwan's sovereignty and its international space. We see it in the growing number of businesses that China is forcing, at the risk of them losing access to China's markets, into labeling Taiwan as a Chinese state on their maps. We see the constraint specifically in the way China has been conducting an astounding number of naval and Air Force training missions near Taiwan and in China's activities in the South China Sea, building and militarizing islands, and then using them to actively shape the future battleground in a way that will block crucial sea routes. This will narrow Taiwan's options and weaken its capacity to rely on external powers such as the U.S. And as China sees more clearly that time is not on its side and that it must act now to prevent Taiwan from achieving formal independence, the Chinese are thinking more and more about the fifth toolkit, force. China would rather avoid military confrontation over Taiwan, but the toolkit is open, and Taiwan is putting more advanced weapons and strategies and options into that toolkit each year. The cost of an invasion and occupation would be high. But Roger Baker writes, quote, "The balance has clearly tilted in favor of China, including even in several scenarios where the U.S. intervenes in a cross-strait conflict." End quote. So in the months ahead, we should expect to see China keep on using disruption, isolation, and constraint. And we'll see it keep making preparation for the fifth toolkit, force. This will include strengthening its artificial islands so they can function as forward bases and so that they can allow China interdiction of maritime routes in the region. China will also deploy more anti-ship and anti-air missiles, including hypersonic missiles that can strike Taiwan with debilitating force. We can also expect China to ramp up training for its aircraft carrier battle groups and various amphibious operations, and for it to increasingly use its fisherman navy to keep a consistent presence in the locations that it claims in order to demonstrate control over them. And we will likely see China try various methods of blockades in the region to disrupt other nations' economic and security connections to Taiwan. And eventually, we can be sure that China will swallow Taiwan up. And that will happen mainly because of America's decline. The Taiwanese have managed for all these years to resist China's five toolkits and to stay independent, thanks almost entirely to military equipment, political support, and security assurances from the United States. But the U.S. today is deeply divided and war-weary, and America's will to use its power in any meaningful way is essentially broken. Back in 1998, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury said America's decline made it clear that it was only a matter of time before Taiwan would be swallowed by China. He wrote an insightful article at that time called Taiwan Betrayal, and one part of it says, quote, "How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? It is going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America." End quote. From there, Mr. Fleury explained that his assessment of the China-Taiwan-U.S. dynamic is based on a Bible prophecy recorded in the book of Leviticus. This passage says America would become mired in sin, and then its will to use its power would be broken. And back in 1998, when that was written, the idea of Taiwan being swallowed up by China may have seemed possible only in the distant future. But today, with America weakening so quickly, and with China seeing that time is no longer on its side with Taiwan, and now preparing to use its growing power against it, it's easy to see how Mr. Fleury's forecast will soon become reality.
That was trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques speaking about China's increasingly aggressive policy toward Taiwan. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. And in the meantime, read Gerald Fleury's article, Taiwan Betrayal. You can find that in the show notes for this program at thetrumpet.com.
It's time for today's last word.
What is the quality of your thinking? Are you skilled at analyzing problems? Can you concentrate on the things you want to concentrate on? How deep a thinker are you? How we think is critical. Our thoughts govern everything we do and the attitude with which we do it. Thinking is the core of our being. Superficial, unfocused thinking produces a superficial, unfocused life. Our world is full of distractions, cluttering our mind with trivialities. Our overstimulated, technology-driven, information-saturated modern life is too noisy for us to hear ourselves think. Maybe you encounter something important and you think, well, that's great, I need to do that. I need to change my thinking, change my life in that way. But then you get distracted by something else. Our world is deeply hostile to serious thought, serious life-changing thought. I realize information is not the same thing as understanding. Of course, the stupid amusement that dulls the mind, that's a distraction, but anything can be a distraction. Information, even good information, becomes another distraction if you're not thinking about it, evaluating it, analyzing it, if it's not stimulating your mind in original directions. Distractions crowd our mind with inferior thoughts. Vigorous thinking is fundamentally a matter of replacing inferior thoughts with quality thoughts. If you want to improve your thinking, you have to turn the inferior thoughts off, exercise an act of will that creates some quiet and clears space for something of substance. Thinking deeply is a matter of restricting mental associations, so you repeatedly and purposefully mull a particular thing. It requires eliminating irrelevant thoughts, those musings that crowd your mind and pull you off the subject you want to be pondering. The Apostle Paul advocated such mental discipline. He spoke of bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. This requires a moment-by-moment awareness of and restraint over the images, impressions, and ideas that float through the mind and expunging anything unwelcome. That's basically what concentration is. How do you do it? Well, you may want a quick fix, but concentration is a skill acquired with practice, just like poor, petty thinking is a habit strengthened by years of practice. If you aren't used to focusing your attention, you can't suddenly summon the knack. It requires habitual, concerted deliberation. But there is a trick to learning it. Here's a simple truth about how your mind works. You naturally concentrate on what you enjoy. In a wonderful little book written in 1929 called The Art of Thinking, Ernest Dimnay wrote, "Real interest is essential for concentration and creates it in an instant. The same boy who goes a wool gathering when he has to write a literary essay can concentrate for half a day on mathematics or on a new radio implement." So concentrate on those things you enjoy, or learn to enjoy those things you must concentrate on. At least you can consciously practice concentrating on the more satisfying things and progressively work toward applying the skill elsewhere. Dimnay advocated populating your mind with greatness. He wrote, "It's impossible to spend an hour in a room with a man approaching greatness without feeling the contagiousness of distinguished thinking. He said to read about great thinkers, read the writings of great thinkers. He wrote, "Our serious hours cannot be devoted to a more useful occupation than studying the lives or ideas of great men." And he threw out this challenge. If at any moment you are unable to name a great man who is or has recently been having an influence on your conduct, you will be passing the verdict ordinary on the quality of your own thought and existence. Who do you spend your time with? Their influence on you looms larger than you'd like to believe. Scripture is filled with admonitions like Proverbs 13 and verse 20. "He that walks with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed." So find those wise men and women, and then really converse, meet minds, think deeply together. When you read, what do you read? What is the quality of the food you feed your mind? And just as important, when you read, how much do you think? Studying something to the point where it actually changes you requires letting it soak into the folds of your gray matter. Be honest, how much of your reading is forgotten the moment you stop? Yes, read more, but as you read, read less. Think more. It's the road less traveled, but if you really want to change your life, it's the only route to take. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. If you want to send me any thoughts on today's program, you can write letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brian Byrne and Jeremiah Jacques. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from F.P. Jones. Experience is that marvelous thing that enables you to recognize a mistake when you make it again. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.